Yeah, it's another day, but what kind of day is it really? A day of doom scrolling? Laundry day? Nah, it's a White Claw day. Light and refreshing tasting, uniquely cold way filtered. There's an iconic flavor for everyone. So grab a pack, grab your friends. Make the most of each day with those who matter most. When you're together with White Claw, every day is a once in a lifetime experience. You just gotta grab it. White Claw. Grab life by the claw. Please drink responsibly. Hard seltzer with flavors. White Claw seltzer works Chicago, Illinois.
Hey, Cam, mind sending me over our new Wi-Fi password?
Oh, sorry, Mitch, you can't be trusted.
What?
It's your phone. It's different than mine.
Cam! And I thought I was a judgy one.
No, it's just messages between different devices aren't encrypted.
Okay. Since when do you know about encryption?
I know what encryption is, and it's because I'm the last line of defense against any would-be Wi-Fi thieves.
Cam, come on.
Okay, fine. I'll send it somewhere more private.
Thank you.
Safely send messages between different devices. On WhatsApp. Message privately with everyone.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm getting married today. I'm also a firefighter and first responder. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I can make it to my ceremony to start the next chapter of my life.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey. June's Journey is a hidden object mystery mobile game that puts your detective skills to the test. Embark on a journey into a gripping narrative where intrigue, secrets, and unexpected twists await at every turn. Play as June Parker and investigate beautifully detailed scenes of the 1920s whilst uncovering the mystery of her sister's murder. Rediscover the magic of June's childhood as you roam the vast estate filled with secrets and memories waiting to be uncovered. Gather compelling evidence and decipher clues, immersing yourself in a captivating world of discovery that will keep you hooked until the very end. Compete with friends and other players to see who can solve cases the fastest or achieve the highest scores. Are you ready to jump back in time, detectives? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Discover the secrets of the past. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. John F. Kennedy's life is promoted by sentimental mythmakers as pure legend, but a sinister shadow lies across his life. JFK's death was such a shocking event that the vivid memory of his assassination still blinds us to much of what went before. It is almost always seen through the prism of that single terrible day in Dallas, obscuring the dark corners of his life and government. For JFK, power was soundbites over policy, the White House a fairy tale castle, and the president a hypersexualized movie star. As with Hollywood, the willing suspension of belief was required. Reality imposes no such limits. Drawing on essential new material, Reckless shatters the secrets and lies with a revelatory true life thriller focusing on RFK and Robert F. Kennedy, both before and after they bought the White House. All the usual suspects, from FBI titan J. Edgar Hoover and billionaire Howard Hughes to CIA rogue agents and mob hitmen, appear in a narrative which sweeps from wartime London to the salons of Washington, from the bedrooms of Hollywood to the torture chambers and jungles of Central America, and on to revolutionary Cuba and the tragic, bloody political carousel of Vietnam. The book that we're featuring this evening is Reckless: Sex, Lies, and JFK, with my special guest, investigative journalist and author, Douglas Thompson. Good evening and welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Douglas Thompson.
Hello, Dan. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this extraordinary book, Reckless.
That's great. Thank you. It's been a long time in writing, so it's good to it's out now in the bookshops, and people are reacting to it and getting another side of the whole history of a little history of America, but mainly, of course, of John F. Kennedy and his family.
Yes, as you do in the book, just to start in a very dramatic fashion, you have Havana, Cuba, 1957. And Santo Traficante Jr. on the phone with his lawyer complaining. Tell us about what his complaint is.
Yeah, Traficante, who was one of the big mob mafia figures of America in the 50s and into the 60s, was very angry. He had tried to set up the then young Senator John F. Kennedy in a kind of honey trap in Havana, using some very attractive and very alluring Cuban girls to entice Kennedy and a colleague of his into sex in a hotel room. Traficante had set up a camera setup in the next door hotel room with a kind of see-through wall. And the whole plan was to photograph and compromise Kennedy and blackmail him into the future. Problem was that Traficante's helpers hadn't quite got the technology correct, and so the photographs never ever came out, much to his indignation, and that's why he was on to his lawyer complaining. It's basically saying, if I had only got this son of a bitch on camera, things would have been much different. He, typically of the mob, of course, he didn't blame his own kind of actions or his own management of the situation. He blamed the colleagues who had tried to set up this mini camera to work and snap Kennedy literally in sexual action. Of course, the colleague was admonished in a nasty way, but if Kennedy himself and his friends just carried on without any knowledge that they had been so close to being compromised. And I would think, you imagine, a future completely ruined before it had really begun in politics in America.
Take us back, take our audience back to the origins of Joseph Kennedy, as you do in the book.
John Kennedy's behavior in Havana was very much a mirror of his own father's behavior, going back into the 1920s and to Boston and to his whole attitude to life, his attitude of entitlement. Old Joe Kennedy had a great gift for making money. Didn't care how he made it through connections with mob figures like Santo Traficante's father, who was also a Traficante. And throughout the years, Joe Kennedy manipulated people. He manipulated banks. He manipulated situations, and he was, it's now become clear, it had always been rumored that he was a kind of bootlegger during Prohibition, but over the years, it's suddenly been clearer and clearer, and certainly with freedom of information in the last 10, 15 years, there's been more detail come out about how close he was working with the mob, working and running his own booze, which he imported into Boston, it came into New York, it came down from Canada, and some of the most prestigious speakeasies, kind of legendary names of going back to the 1920s of all those, you think of all these old Warner Brothers gangster movies with Cagney and George Raft. Joe Kennedy could have been could have been a player in any of these movie scripts. He was that involved, but kept through connections, through manipulation, as I said, I think really was his middle name, of the press. He became very friendly with Walter Winchell. So, you know, when Kennedy, if there was rumors or scandal about him, that was all quelled, didn't appear, and favors were given. So Kennedy would give Winchell and others, including some of the big papers, the Washington Post, New York Times, would give them the dirt on other people to keep himself looking very, well, not squeaky clean, but looking clean enough to stay out of jail, stay out of compromise. And his affiliations were always towards those in power. So he did favors, you know, with mobsters who were in power. He did favors for politicians who were in power. And he went on to do that in a grand way with Roosevelt, who he supported for the presidency, where at the same time, all the time, thinking of his own political ambition. When he, and of course, the Boston dynasty begins through Joe Kennedy. They'd come been dirty tricks with Fitzgerald's, with his wife Rose Fitzgerald's family in Boston politics. But later on, he gets in there and he is using the money all the time to buy influence, to buy votes, to buy elections. And this went on and would go on for decades. And his family, his big ambition was for his eldest son, Joe Kennedy, to ultimately become president. And Joe Jr. was very much trained for it, educated for it. And second son, John Kennedy, was in the slipstream of this, also being well-educated and prepared for political office, but not the high office that his older brother was destined for. The Second World War, when America entered the Second World War, very much against Joe Kennedy's fearsome, very fearsome opposition and lobbying against. And Kennedy was sort of bought off in a way with becoming the U.S. ambassador to London. So he's in London. He's also at that time still fighting American involvement in the war. He's championing appeasement. He's upsetting then MPs like Winston Churchill and canoodling to a degree. I say canoodling. He's flirting with Hitler and trying to really see peace with America and letting Europe get on with the war and not involve the States. He did his reputation no good at all because of this. At the same time, he had the tragic thing of his son, Joe, was flying an experimental flight with a lot of 20,000 tons of TNT on board.
Right.
And that exploded over England, over Suffolk in England. So Joe Kennedy is tragically killed. Joe Kennedy Jr., that is. Joe Kennedy Sr. then goes back to the States with his tail between his legs, really. But to keep him sweet and keep him sort of in the tent rather than outside the tent, Roosevelt looks after him with appointments there. But at that point, of course, the mantle of who will become president of the family goes to JFK. And that's where, again, a whole not new, but a newly revived campaign, political campaign, begins, all centered again on Kennedy, this time John Jack Kennedy, and centered on Boston and getting him into high political, or on the ladder to high political office at that point.
Let's go back, because I think it's very important for the behavior of Joe Kennedy, talking about his flirtation with Hollywood. You talk about before Prohibition, making money in the movie business, having affairs with Hollywood starlets. Tell us about this behavior, this risky, reckless behavior that's demonstrated in this book, Reckless.
Yeah. Joe Kennedy, he saw in Hollywood an opportunity to make money. He looked out there, he looked to the coast And he had money, he had the banker's money, and he went up there and he thought he could do better running a studio, making movies, making money. Also, he was away from home. He had the delights of, I mean, it was starlets day and night. The philandering went on constantly. He became quite enamored with Gloria Swanson, who was then the biggest star, female leading lady in the world. He took over her kind of love life and her professional life in terms of her business and making films. They were successful films, but basically Joe Kennedy took all the money, made an absolute fortune in Hollywood, managed to all but bankrupt Gloria Swanson in the process, was involved in rumors that he'd had people murdered, which was a nonsense. But he was such a disliked character and such a reckless and maverick in Hollywood that the whole of Hollywood was desperate to believe that he was going to be found guilty and stuck in the slammer. But his behavior with Gloria Swanson as a son of other women was just, when you look back now, it seems beyond the pale, because by that time, a large family. By then, he'd had 8 children. Rose Kennedy looked the other way. He was having affairs he seemed to be with everybody. Every woman he met, he seemed to go to bed with. But the ongoing relationship with Gloria Swanson was quite incredible. He took the family, to appease the family, he took them all to the south of France and was kind of camped out there in some great style and luxury. And next door to him, in the south of France, also staying in the next door villa, was Marlene Dietrich with her husband and his lover, his male lover, and her family. And of course, then Joe Kennedy being Joe Kennedy, and I suppose Dietrich being Dietrich, they begin an affair then. And during that time, there's a big a society dance, the science evening is staged, which Jack Kennedy is then, I think, then 21, around about 21. And he is there and is entertained along with all the other kids and the people that sat there. And of course, Marlene Dietrich dances with him and sticks her hand down his trousers and tries to arouse him.
Wow.
And she's been sleeping with the father. I mean, it's just, it kind of beggars belief when you kind of see it in black and white now. And you think, of course, the influence on John Kennedy then, who later on sees his father in a kind of sexual clinch with Gloria Swanson, you do wonder just how much his own later philandering was just a kind of stepping stone, you know, in his mind, just something you did as part of being a man.
Let's talk about some of the investments that Joe Kennedy undertook with his mob friends. What kinds of things did he invest in with them?
Joe Kennedy's main investments were in, obviously during Prohibition, he was very much into importing and selling illegal booze and supplying it rather than being the front man. After Prohibition ended, he went into the booze business because he obviously had the connections, and they also bought up very big real estate, clubs, Florida, Midwest, money into that. There was money into Boston, into clubs and warehousing, a lot of warehousing as well, because obviously distribution, it's, in a sense, he was ahead of Amazon by decades.
Right.
And that they built big distribution centers for booze and for any kind of contraband. But nightclubs, he was involved in buying into nightclubs, which were mob run. He had percentages, and then he was also into Las Vegas and into putting money into clubs in Vegas, and mainly into some of the big casinos.
Let's talk about what was learned and what was gained in Honduras, the country of Honduras, before we talk about what was the interest of the mob in Cuba.
In Honduras, the mafia with gambling, the mafia's intention, and it goes back to, through Mayor Lansky, basically the chairman of the board and the money man, the chancellor of the exchequer for the mob, always thought gambling was the way they could expand worldwide. It begins in the carpet, the carpet joints of America, Midwest, then they have Vegas, interest in there, starting up Vegas. But then Honduras was wide open. Guatemala was wide open. They tried to get into Asia. That way, the idea was to get in from there and then get into Asia. And again, Guatemala led to Cuba. Cuba again was just with Batista, who was then running the country, was corrupt, again manipulated into taking a chunk of the gambling with the mob. So it's a money machine. Gambling attracted the people that could run and be tough, and that's what Joe Kennedy was. So he's investing in much of this as the mob is, and of course all the things that go along, all the prostitution, the protection rackets, the illegalities, where the money is made and the skim is made, all kind of runs along with gambling. So you've got, in sort of in tandem, you've got the mafia's empire is running in a very, very swift way through the world, much as Kennedy's politics and business are running very, very quickly as well, and his influence. So you've got that kind of two great dynasties. You've got the Kennedy dynasty, and you've got the mob with their engines both fully, fully steamed up. And they're running through that early first half century of America, and then expanding as America expanded its influence throughout, into Asia and elsewhere. The mob were doing the same thing, and still are. I mean, the mob is still, aimed at, came into the UK, it went into Africa. They had casinos running early days in Russia. So it's expansionist. And strangely enough, the Joe Kennedy trying to be an isolationist during the war is a completely expansionist when it comes to running a business empire, making a dollar. And that's the point, both with Joe Kennedy and with the mafia. Where you got into trouble was when there was somebody got in the way of either of them in the business of making a dollar. If you let them just get on with it, there was never any trouble for people in their vicinity or working with them. It was only when authority or someone else, a rival came on the scene and wanted to get in the way.
Tell us about the government's involvement and why they, despite Batista's cruelty and violence and murder, they still like Batista as the head of Cuba, and why?
Basically, American governments have consistently supported figures, be they dictators, be they cruel dictators, who have been anti-communist. We know it throughout the kind of history of Central America and so on. But very much Batista was a buffer against the Castro, the Che Guevara politics, which were, the intelligence was telling them that was coming along. Very much the same happened in Guatemala. The government there was believed to be going, well, not believed, it was becoming very socialist. The new president was a believer in giving everybody in the country a piece of land, a share in their own lives and daily kind of livelihood, making a livelihood. And this was frowned upon. So he's assassinated in Guatemala. And the new kind of figurehead comes in, who is far more equitable towards the politics of Washington. It's repeated along the way, the mob has a hand in helping the governments. It's thought that the mob were kind of in the dark all the way through. But Lucky Luciano, during the Second World War, partnered up with the government to protect the docks in New York because he had the influence to keep the mobsters in there, and they kept the communists and the sort of what they saw as left-wing threats calmed down. So that continued after the war. It continues in Cuba. It continued in Guatemala, Honduras, and it certainly goes into Cuba until Castro takes power, until Batista is overthrown.
You talk about, and I guess people believe they know quite a bit about this, but it should be discussed, is the idea about Cuba and the assassination of Castro and those plans.
The myriad. I mean, there were so many. We've kind of grown to see it kind of almost in a Saturday Night Live way, with kind of exploding cigars and, you know, bats flying in and dropping poison on his food and all kinds of crazy schemes that came up. And we think, oh, that's how ridiculous and how amusing. But actually, when you go through all the CIA documents through Freedom of Information, when you go through the files, there is probably not a wacky idea that wasn't put forward as a plan to kill Castro. And it still astonishes me how Castro survived, because there were so many different plots and so many ways that he was going to be eliminated with very much extreme prejudice, but nothing ever happened. The mob, this guy called Johnny Roselli, who was the mob's man in Hollywood from the 40s onwards, he was a very much a killer, cold-blooded, very clever, very street smart, clever, and he worked with the CIA and FBI, was monitored by co-author Mike Rothmiller's Los Angeles Police Department. He kind of watched him at all times, because what Roselli was doing was usually what was important in terms of heinous crime and manipulation of events. And Roselli was recruited to hit Castro and to set it all up. There have been so many different variations of what happened or what tried to happen. But basically, there were several attempts. There was a sniper was taken into Cuba, to Havana, and nearly got a shot off Castro. There was poisoned food through an intrigue with a chef who was kind of blackmailed or compromised sexually. There was two or three attempts to kidnap Castro. One attempt, in fact, they kidnapped somebody who looked like Castro. You could fill a book with all the various kind of, it's like the Keystone Cops, the way things went on. Very, very, basically everything went wrong because there were so many people trying to deny that they were trying to do anything. You had the government who didn't want anybody to know that the mob were involved. You had the mob trying to cover up their involvement as well, because they want to keep in. They're playing two sides. The mob's most important thing to them was to get back into Cuba and get the gambling going again. And they always thought if Batista wasn't there, maybe they could do a deal with Castro. Their belief to this day is that everybody is corruptible, so why wouldn't Castro be at some point? So it's a kind of madcap carry on throughout the whole thing. And basically, Castro, when he is in power, and when he takes power, and when Kennedy becomes president, he's virtually thumbing his nose at him. And it makes the point to Kennedy publicly in a speech that Castro says on the record that Cuba is no Guatemala. And of course, in Guatemala, the president had been killed in Guatemala by supposedly one of his own bodyguards, who supposedly took his own life and who supposedly was a left-wing communist sympathizer with ties to Moscow, and pamphlets were found in his apartment and supposedly communications between the killer, the assassin, and Moscow. As it turned out, when everybody investigated, there seemed to be no connection between the bodyguard who supposedly did the killing and any of this supposed communist sympathies. Basically, he was the patsy, he was the fall guy, he was the one who was found guilty, and the case was closed, and the new president was put in. But if you look at the circumstances, and you look at onto Dallas, and you know, not that many years later, 6 years later, the mirror, it kind of mirrors, it looks like a dry run. With hindsight, it looks like a dry run for the Kennedy assassination.
Let's get back to, given the behavior, the risky sexual behavior that JFK exhibited, there are not only the mob trying to set him up in honey traps and have their prostitutes talking to JFK and being involved with him, but also that the government, you mentioned the LAPD's department, OCID, gathering information on stars and criminals for their own purpose. But given the behavior of JFK, tell us about the people that want to have him compromised.
What they want is leverage with a powerful figure in government. And so basically it is the mob and his political rivals, but you've also got foreign countries. During the war, Kennedy had an affair with a woman who was suspected of being a Nazi sympathizer who'd had connections with Hitler, mm-hmm. watched as a journalist and so on. So they had the history of that. He'd almost got him thrown out of the Navy through his father, through Joe Kennedy's influence. He stayed there. He was moved out of Washington to a less sensitive area. He continued the affair. He continued the affair in later years. There was always a connection there. There was also a situation with a kind of communist ring in Washington, in which, and again, Kennedy is compromised and has an affair. It's covered up. It's smoothed over. But at all the times, there are people monitoring him, and the reckless behavior is astonishing. I mean, he had a very poorly controlled Addison's disease. He was given anabolic steroids for this. There has been psychiatric testimony in books and evidence and put forward that this affected his thinking and so on. But you do have to wonder where the conscience is, A, with Joe Kennedy Sr. and with Jack Kennedy, because he's meeting women, he is having affairs with them while he is trying to become a senator, a congressman. He's doing it. He's doing it before he becomes a senator. He's doing it before he becomes president. He's doing it almost on the eve of his inauguration as president. He's doing it continually throughout his presidency. Reckless behavior, but you're almost thinking, how many more women are there? I mean, how many more pages do you have to write about the women? It's almost an embarrassment of kind of riches in a sense, of material. But of course, the mob wanted to get him early on, and you know, Trafficante's idea of photographing him, compromising him in Cuba was a perfectly legitimate idea from their point of view, which didn't work out. There were pictures of him taken outside an apartment of a lover in the middle of the night. This was, again, all covered up. Pressure was put on from on high, because it seems that nobody could quite comprehend what was happening. The LAPD in California, throughout the Kennedys' kind of association with California, anytime when he got the nomination in Los Angeles in 60, the LAPD is basically covering up his affair with Marilyn Monroe. it's covering up his affair with other actresses, a couple who are still alive. He's covering up his tracks, basically looking after him, almost babysitting the candidate, then babysitting the president when he was in California, much as they babysat Bobby Kennedy, you know, his brother, who was then Attorney General, and helped him and helped Bobby Kennedy with his work against the mob and his difficulties with covering up his brother's affairs. And of course, all at this time, Jack Kennedy is heavily involved with Frank Sinatra, with the movie set, with the scandals there. And not a word of this is appearing in a hint of it in European newspapers and magazines, often blind items, and the occasional blind item in American gossip columns. But certainly it's sanitized in terms of the mainstream media.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey. June's Journey is a hidden object mystery mobile game that puts your detective skills to the test. Embark on a journey into a gripping narrative where intrigue, secrets, and unexpected twists await at every turn. Play as June Parker and investigate beautifully detailed scenes of the 1920s whilst uncovering the mystery of her sister's murder. Rediscover the magic of June's childhood as you roam the vast estate filled with secrets and memories waiting to be uncovered. Gather compelling evidence and decipher clues, immersing yourself in a captivating world of discovery that will keep you hooked until the very end. Compete with friends and other players to see who can solve cases the fastest or achieve the highest scores. Are you ready to jump back in time, detectives? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Discover the secrets of the past. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Let's talk about Bobby Kennedy, his rise to the Attorney General, and also Joe Kennedy utilizing his friends to help JFK get into the White House. And just tell us about Bobby Kennedy throwing a monkey wrench into this.
Jack Kennedy is on the campaign trail. Bobby Kennedy is his campaign manager. And basically, they are working together at a high, high pace. But the Joe Kennedy is manipulating behind the scenes with money, putting a massive and massive amounts of money into this. But Joe has done the deal with the mob, that the mob will help his son become president. At the same time, Bobby Kennedy is leading as a prominent anti-mob, anti-racketeering lawyer, is leading a campaign to alienate the mob, to get them in prison, to put them all away. So you've got two conflicting brothers with two conflicting kind of ideals at that point. And the Joe, as Kennedy Sr., is the whole time trying to pull his son back, saying, don't stop going after them. But at hearing after hearing Bobby Kennedy in public, he abuses Sam Giancana, who is the mob boss in Chicago, probably the most powerful mafia man in America. He is friends, Giancana, with Frank Sinatra. Giancana is friends with Joe Kennedy Sr. Giancana has promised Joe Kennedy Sr. that he will help him buy votes and influence votes to put his son in the White House. At the same time, Bobby Kennedy is what's the word? He is kind of belittling Sam Giancana publicly, laughing at him for having a shrill laugh and a voice at some hearings, and angering, and very much angering Sam Giancana, who is in, at this point in two minds where he will help. So Joe Kennedy is then at this point having to flirt and make promises about Giancana that his son will back off from the mob, that if Kennedy becomes president, the mob will get an easy ride. There won't be this terrible onslaught to have them put behind bars and to basically stop making money, which was the great threat, always the great threat to the mob.
Tell us what Frank Sinatra was asked to do by the mob.
Frank Sinatra, who was always associated with the mafia from his very early days in New Jersey, was kind of enrolled by the mafia, by Sam Giancana personally, to be a go-between between the Kennedys and Giancana for the buying of votes to swing the election in Jack Kennedy's favor. It all became extremely complicated and difficult. There were secret meetings between Giancana and Kennedy, Giancana and Sinatra and Joe Kennedy. I mean, Joe Kennedy met Sinatra on a golf course, and they basically did a deal whereby the mob would be entertained in their request to have an easy time in return for votes or vote manipulation. What complicated all of this was that one Sinatra evening in Las Vegas, Jack Kennedy had been campaigning and been introduced to one of Sinatra's girlfriends, a lady called Judith Exner. Now, Judith Exner became an obsession with John Kennedy. Unfortunately, for Kennedy, well, and interestingly, I mean, for history, really, she was also the mistress of Sam Giancana, the mafia boss. So there we have it, that the future president and later the president of the United States is sleeping with the same woman as the head of the godfather of the Chicago mafia. It's probably one of the more illuminative sexual triangles in American history. But of course, it gave a lot of power to the other great figure of this whole era, J. Edgar Hoover, who, if the Los Angeles Police Department Intelligence Division had dirt on starlets and politicians, it was only their collection was only rivaled by that of Hoover. And Hoover, he had wiretaps on everybody. He knew who Giancana was speaking to. He knew who the Kennedys were speaking to. There are tapes of these conversations. We listen, you know, Mike Rothmuller and I had access to some conversations that were had, which basically what they do is they back up the connection. They back up the support and they validate lots of rumor, because you've got the voices, you've got the real people speaking and plotting. You don't really hear people plotting assassinations or detail of great nefarious activity, but you hear them discussing manipulating events and being kind to each other and doing people a favor. They're very careful on how and what they say, but it's a language of chess. It's a sign language, and they know how to move the pieces just by an inference, a pause, or the mention of a certain name. And I think that's, so you've got running the kind of American underworld or that underbelly of government the whole time. You have these a different government. You have an underworld government working at the same pace as the Washington government. What today people would call it deep state and have all kinds of names for it and conspiracy and so on. But then it was far more blatant. It was it was kept away from the public, but certainly people in Washington knew what was going on. People around the Kennedy White House knew what was going on. People around Joe Kennedy knew what was happening. It's like Jack Kennedy, he didn't hide the for instance, the sex thing, which today with the Me Too movements and so on, Kennedy just cuddling an intern would have been seen him out the door. Whereas then at that time, he's having sex with different interns on different days, sometimes two in the same day, and then having someone else visiting him in the evening. It kind of begs belief. Where were the Secret Service? What is going on here? And this is all happening as though it was acceptable. I think by the latter end of the Kennedy presidency, a lot of these things had happened in the late 50s and had happened during his term in office were beginning to rush into the freeway, so that the freeway's becoming into one lane, and eventually that lane was going to smack in everybody on that. All the traffic was going to smash up to something, because I don't think it could have been the lid could have been kept on it much longer. And obviously, political opponents, they knew about it. They knew things, so the dirt would certainly, I think, would have come out in some sort of at the next election. It would have been thrown around.
So you talk about this triangle, the sexual triangle that with Judith Exner and Giancana and JFK, but another weird sex triangle was going on with Marilyn Monroe, with Peter Lawford, the in-law, introducing Marilyn Monroe to JFK and also Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, I mean, the everlasting headline, JFK's affair with Marilyn Monroe, whom he met at a party in New York, thrown by the agent of his brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, the British actor, who had married into the Kennedy family, much to the distress of Joe Kennedy Sr. Marilyn is then married to Joe DiMaggio, a baseball star, who they meet at that, when Kennedy quite obviously is flirting with DiMaggio's wife. DiMaggio gets very angry about it, takes Marilyn away. But Kennedy has got hold of Marilyn's telephone number during their conversation, and the approach is made, the affair begins, and carries on at great length. Marilyn is obsessed with Kennedy as he is with her. And she's back in California. Kennedy's in Washington. There are many, many phone calls logged from Marilyn to the White House and to Bobby Kennedy as well. Marilyn gets involved sexually with Bobby Kennedy. It becomes a real turmoil for everybody involved in it, because she is used basically by the Kennedys. As a plaything, the promises are made. She, famously sings "Happy Birthday, Mr. President." But at that evening, after the "Happy Birthday, Mr. President" performance, she is disabused by Bobby Kennedy that they will have anything to do with her. I mean, she at that stage thinks that Bobby Kennedy will leave his wife for her, that Jack Kennedy might come back to her. It's a whole messy, messy thing. And she's also threatening to go public later on and throws various tantrums, mainly tantrums on the telephone. In an earlier book I did with Mike Rothmiller, Mike had the OCID files on the death of Marilyn Monroe. And Peter Lawford explains how he went with Bobby Kennedy to Marilyn's home in Brentwood, and just outside Los Angeles, and confronted Marilyn about what she was or wasn't going to say or go public with the weekend that Marilyn died. In the book, it explains how Lawford went back, and that Bobby Kennedy gave Marlon a glass of to camera down a glass containing something, and within seconds, or very certainly within a minute, Marlon was comatose, and very quickly afterwards, Lawford said she was dead, and they left the premises. At which point, the LAPD OCID squad, led by Captain James Hamilton, came in, and Hamilton was a great friend of Bobby Kennedy's, and had protected the Kennedy family, and began the cover up, which went on for 60 years. So the Marlon Monroe thing, whole, when I say thing, the whole relationships was about to explode at the time of Marlon's death. And kind of the suspicions, the rumor, and the kind of the detritus from that situation, it hung around like a very bad smell, right the way, all the way across America to Washington from then on. And I think it did color a lot of the attitudes towards Kennedy, because whether you believe they were directly instrumental in her death, people believe that they had in some way put her in harm's way. And I think that was the kind of start of the tarnishing of Camelot, if you like, of this golden Kennedy era. And of course, the assassination of Kennedy. And I think that is the kind of brings down a curtain, a sort of iron curtain, on all the scandal, all the bad behavior, the reckless behavior of Bobby Kennedy, of Teddy Kennedy, and certainly of Joe Kennedy Senior, because the assassination is such a shocking event. I mean, it's on television. I mean, it's still today. Majority of people can imagine, can see in their own mind that footage, because it's been played so many times, and because we view it through that event, the history of the Kennedys, I think for decades, the myth has been allowed to sort of predominate in our thinking and in our view of what happened. It's only now, and I think people were cynical then. I think we're possibly, time has allowed America to catch up with the rest of the world and being more cynical about what the Kennedys were about, and I keep using the word manipulation, and I think, and it was, I mean, they manipulated themselves. They used their own charm, their kind of good look, their ability to talk to anyone, to convince anybody of their argument. There's an interesting theory put forward too, by the wives, who I'm sure Kennedy flirted with, of all his kind of White House colleagues and associates, his political supporters, that all the men, all their husbands and their brothers, their uncles, their fathers, they all wanted to please Kennedy as well. They all wanted to be part of that inner circle, to get that beaming smile, to get a pat on the, he was a great one for patting people on the shoulder or taking them by the arm, that tactical or tactile kind of association. And because of that, the charm overrode all the kind of misdeeds, if you like. And I think you talk about Camelot and the chivalry and the knights and round table and all this stuff, but you think how unchivalrous was the treatment of the women who were used and then discarded without much of a thought. And I think people were as well. I think the case of Lyndon Johnson, who was helpful to the Kennedys in getting Texas to vote for Kennedy and get Kennedy, well, basically Lyndon Johnson helped him get in the White House with the Texas vote. But then he's sidelined, Lyndon Johnson sidelined, until he is useful again in certain situations. So the history of the Kennedys is not a good one. Peter Lawford, is an interesting metaphor for the they used him. He married into the family. He's a favored son-in-law. He pimps. No question about it. He pimps for the Kennedys. Shirley Ann Field, who was a British actress, was seen on the Johnny Carson show by Jack Kennedy, who fancied her. He gets Peter Lawford to invite her to a presidential event. I talked to her at great length about it. She had no illusions that he wanted to go to bed with her. She avoided that on their first meeting official because she was filming the next day, kind of sidestepped that assignation because her agent said, don't get involved. You'll just be tagged as another actress who slept with Jack Kennedy. And shortly afterwards, she's invited out to Peter Lawford's place in Santa Monica in California, where Kennedy will be for a party. And so it was just ongoing. So Peter Lawford, he provides Marilyn Monroe, he tries to provide Shirley Ann Field, he provides countless other actresses. But when Lawford's time he's divorced, he's no longer a member of the Kennedy family, Jack Kennedy has been assassinated, Bobby Kennedy has been assassinated. Peter Lawford, when he dies in the early 1984, I think, he's interred in Westwood Memorial Park, strangely enough, around the corner from Marilyn Monroe on the thing. The bill for this kind of space is put down to the Kennedy family, that they will meet the bills of Peter Lawford's life, or afterlife, I should say, in West Hollywood.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear these messages.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey. June's Journey is a hidden object mystery mobile game that puts your detective skills to the test. Embark on a journey into a gripping narrative where intrigue, secrets, and unexpected twists await at every turn. Play as June Parker and investigate beautifully detailed scenes of the 1920s, whilst uncovering the mystery of her sister's murder. Rediscover the magic of June's childhood as you roam the vast estate filled with secrets and memories waiting to be uncovered. Gather compelling evidence and decipher clues, immersing yourself in a captivating world of discovery that will keep you hooked until the very end. Compete with friends and other players to see who can solve cases the fastest or achieve the highest scores. Are you ready to jump back in time, detectives? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Discover the secrets of the past. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Let's get to... You talked about the assassination, and it's already been done in our conversation. But what we haven't talked about is the information, the documentation you have about who ordered this hit, who was talking about that they had to, if they wanted to get to the snake, they had to cut off the head. If they wanted to kill a dog, they wouldn't cut off its tail, they would cut off its head. Tell us about this incredible conversation.
The mob, the mafia in America were offended that the Kennedys did not keep to their agreement that they would be looked after JFK got into the White House. They were angry, livid, ferociously upset by Bobby Kennedy's campaign against them. Carlos Marcello in New Orleans, and very much so, had been abused and disabused by Bobby Kennedy's authorities. And they have a conversation with Carlos Marcello, Sam Giancana, Roselli, Johnny Roselli, and various other mob figures. But it's Marcello basically saying, you know, in the Sicilian way, you have to, you know, if you want to, you have to get rid of Bobby Kennedy, who's wagging the tail, you have to cut off the head, which is JFK. And therefore, that would be their revenge and their retribution for what they believe was the ultimate betrayal they had delivered. And that's the one thing you can't do to save the mob. You make a promise, you keep to the promise, and you certainly don't betray them. And they felt they had been severely betrayed by JFK. And all the documents, all the files now languishing and all kinds of the, and well, basically museums now. But when you hunt it all out and put it all together, the documents are there, which indicate, I think without much doubt, that the mafia were instrumental in arranging and organizing the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
You talk about the fate of Joe Kennedy's friends, Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana. Tell us what happens to Johnny Roselli and then Sam Giancana.
Yeah, well, Johnny Roselli, he was, they called him Handsome Johnny. He was a good-looking guy. And he, because of congressional hearings in Washington about the mob, and Johnny Roselli was a bit too open mouth, said too much, and they and the mob, the hierarchy, feared that he would be would actually squeal, become a stool in their vernacular, a stool pigeon. Roselli played golf on a pretty regular basis in Florida, and then one day he's found his body in a oil drum floating in the ocean and had been basically assassinated in such a way as to send a message with, you know, bullets shot in the head. And that was the end of Johnny Roselli, who had been for many, many years one of the sort of top lieutenants in the American mob. Sam Giancana was about to, had never really said anything or publicly or potentially implicated anybody else. But there was, again, there was this great fear. There was so much pressure on him to appear before Congress and to give testimony and to tell the truth about what had happened, about the assassination. Because if there had been at that time, if you can imagine the outcry and the kind of the whole government enterprise that would come down and dump on top of the mob, I mean, they would not have been able to operate in any way at all. So Giancana was, again, he was at home in Chicago cooking his supper himself when a hitman came in and, again, in a very mob fashion, shot him very professionally two or three times, and he is dead. So all those kind of loose ends. There were several others, names, incidental names, people who may have known, bodies that were suddenly found, mysterious assassinations or killings. And they only last week, and here we are in 2024, Mike Rothmuller was telling me that law enforcement people he knows in Nevada, because of climate change, have been watching the waters in Lake Mead go down. And so far, there's some bodies have been appearing. And he said, basically, not bodies anymore, but they anticipate finding bodily remains and more of them as the water line goes down. Because the mob do tidy up. Tidy up their mistakes and potential hazards are made to go away. And the easiest way to get, it's the old thing, if two people have a secret, if one's dead, you know that somebody, there's not a secret to be held anymore.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You talk about Tony Spilatro taking over, and you say that he may be responsible for those murders you spoke about, 24 murders, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, he was very much a professional kind of killer for the mob. And he, I mean, part of the recompense for it was he goes back into Vegas and becomes a very big pin in Vegas. He is the character that Robert De Niro portrays in Casino. And right. I think, remembering correctly, I think it's in 76. I went to Vegas for the to report on the killing. I mean, he in turn, showing you again, it's not a career with pension plans. I don't think the mob.
No.
He was blown up, I think 76, because basically the hierarchy of the mob believed he was skimming off the take in Vegas, and they weren't getting their full return. So the story, the characters change, but the kind of theme of the story tends to stay the same throughout. And again, you look at the corruption. You know, we read about today in foreign countries, in Washington, in London, in Moscow, the oligarchs, and so on. It's an ongoing correlation between power, criminal enterprise, which one has the upper hand, and at any given time. And the Kennedys. People said to, you know, reviewers of the book of Reckless have said it was a different era. It was a different time. People had different attitudes. But I still can't equate what you would have thought American or world or any, just decency and treatment of fair-minded treatment of people is an ongoing thing. And I don't think they were any different, the people at that time. But just the ones who, you know, we're writing about and talking about today were, in their ways, corrupt, often despicable people who, for their own aggrandizement or benefit, power for money, sexual release of sexual enjoyment, were willing to use other people and to abuse them. And I suppose if there's any sort of great lesson from Reckless, the thing with that, I think it seems so much more enormous now, because you have the ability, after decades of freedom of information, of interviews, of people feeling willing to speak and to come forward with information, that you've got the detail of the activities of the Kennedys, of the mob, of the very, you know, not just big time hitmen, but all the little pawns and people moving around. And because of that, and they're all put together in one volume, if you like, it seems like an indictment. And seems, because it's happening, and it happens over what is a relatively short period of time. You know, the Joe Kennedy, it's you've got a power structure that over decades, but with John Kennedy, you're really looking at over, you know, less than 20 years, maybe even just 15 years of political influence and activity. But so much is put in. I understand the argument that after the Second World War, the world is readjusting. You're trying to find itself again, but it's the opportunists who took over. And it's the opportunists who were writing about in Reckless and who we're talking about, because they became the leading figures of the time. They became, you know, the bosses.
Absolutely. You say in the final pages of this book that Joe Kennedy outlived his three sons and died in 1969, the catalyst for all of this tragedy, you call it this tragedy that occurred.
No, I was going to say, with Joe Kennedy, it's ironic that he did. I mean, you think, you know, the that he did outlive his sons, and he had, and he suffered in that he had a stroke, and he was basically certainly not himself for several years before his death. But I suppose there's a King Lear quality about it and the whole thing, and the sins of the father and so on. But for all the money he made and for all the ambitions and all the dreams and kind of accolades that he really, really wanted, it comes back to that you're all human in the end, and it all comes back to he was just a sad man, unable to talk, and being fed in a wheelchair, and it's tragic. It is a tragedy. I think the whole Kennedy story is a tragedy, and it's a great testament to the political system, to America, and to everything else. That, of course, Kennedy is assassinated, Bobby Kennedy is, but the world, it moves on very quickly. I'm not saying that new bad guys appear just as much as new good guys, but there is a triumph in that the system still seems to overwhelm the people who try and abuse it.
Yes. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your incredible book, Reckless: Sex, Lives, and JFK. For those that might want to find out more information about this book you co-authored with Mike Rothmiller, could you tell us how they might find out more information? Do you have a website or do any social media?
The website, my website, it's www.dougie.com. Has the book there, and if anybody's got any questions, I'm more than happy to answer any emails.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this interview. Thank you so much for this interview, Douglas Thompson, Reckless: Sex, Lives, and JFK. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a good night.
Thank you, Dan, and good night to you.
Thank you.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.